Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast, where editors of Managed Healthcare Executive chat with healthcare executives in the C-Suite and professionals. Our conversations are about the most important issues facing American healthcare today, such as its cost, effectiveness, delivery, organization, and its fairness. Listen in, learn a lot.
Good morning, everybody. Here we are, Zooming from social distance with Francois DeBrant. Francois is Senior Vice President of Commercial Business Development at Signify Health, a company that advises and facilitates payment reform for employers, payers, and providers, and also does work with social determinants of health. So here we are, still in the throes of the COVID outbreak, although I guess various states are beginning to open and maybe some peak is over. But the consequences for healthcare are still being felt and massively so. We've all seen the headlines about the steep declines in revenue and particularly at hospitals, but I think also for doctors. So I guess I reached out to you because I was wondering what the what COVID-19 and the contraction of ordinary medical services and the financial consequences says about where we are with these bundled payments and various payment reforms. It seems that it might indicate that we are still a volume-based healthcare system, and that maybe value-based care is more of a catchphrase than a reality. But I'm not sure how you see it.
Well, we definitely are, and to some extent, many alternative payment models rely on degrees of volume, whether it's volume of patients or volume of procedures, volume of conditions. But it's how you manage those episodes, how you manage those patients, how you manage that volume that ends up by mattering. And to me, COVID has, I think to your point, highlighted a few things. So one, rules that were meant for a specific purpose by Medicare seem oddly antiquated today. And I'll give you a specific example. We've seen, and it's already been reported, we've seen that at least in the Medicare population, the volume of inpatient admissions that otherwise could trigger a bundle under the Medicare bundle payment program decreased by way over 30%. And to varying degrees, depending on the specific type of condition. And while that seems to be creeping back up a little bit, the reason it went down is because most hospitals diverted hospitalizations, encouraged people to stay at home in order to deal with what was expected to be a significant onslaught of patients with COVID. And in certain states like Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, that did happen. In most other states, low double digits or single digits, but the effect was real. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because a lot of the patients whose care was deferred and who potentially should have been hospitalized could have been hospitalized at home. And we've seen some of these models that rely on greater flexibility tried, tested, piloted, but ultimately abandoned. And you sit back and you say, wow, if those patients could have gotten treated at home for that, what otherwise would have been an inpatient admission, they would have gotten the care that they effectively probably did need, but didn't get because they were shut out of the hospital. And so why not look at that, look today as that as an opportunity to loosen some of those restrictions. That's on the facility side. On the physician side, dramatic decreases in the volume of patients. And you're correct in saying that the advancement of alternative payment models has been still very unequal. And for the most part, when you talk to payers, concentrated on large hospitals or health systems. So for example, total cost of care, all, you know, accountable care organization type arrangements, that's valid for a large hospital and health system. It's not valid for the independent physician that practices down the road from where I live. And that independent physician, who happens to be the father of a friend of mine, saw how the volume of his office visits of Medicare patients go down by 90%. Yeah. He had to lay off the physician assistant that's been in his practice for 20 years. He's now looking to align himself with a larger group because he can't sustain, you know, that type of cash flow. For him, if there had been some form of a global payment around management of patient conditions, it would have been a completely different ballgame, because the revenue associated with that payment would have happened, and he wouldn't have to rely on individual services, because what you have is a budget to manage a patient with one or more conditions for a period of time. So I look at COVID as having shown us the flip side of what we always moan about in the FIFA service system, which is when utilization goes down, it's a massive problem for the delivery system. But there are ways of dealing with it in alternative payment models that actually make sense and could avoid the significant financial challenge that a lot of physicians, specialists, and primary care physicians are experiencing.
So if physicians respond to this by aligning themselves with large healthcare systems, do you think that will just retard the progress towards payment reform, and you know this all gets sort of swept under the rug, so to speak, or might it play out differently? I guess I'm just wondering whether the experience coming out of COVID will act as an accelerant, or will it put the brakes on moving towards payment that revolves around, you know, more of a global payment?
So I think it's going to accelerate two things. One, physicians like my friend's father don't want to lose their independence as a practice, but what they're looking for are companies like Allidade, or in our area, ProHealth, which is owned by Optum, because they still respect the practice, but they give you some degree of financial support when times get tough, and they give you other, you know, advantages. So it's different than I'm going to sell myself to a large hospital or health system, who, by the way, may not have the cash to buy.
Yeah, right.
You may not have the cash to buy you. Even with the bailout money, that decrease I talked about is real. That lost revenue, in our estimation, is not coming back. It's lost. And so if you think about why, because if you have a hospitalization for a patient who has an acute exacerbation of COPD that didn't occur because they were stabilized in another environment, that hospitalization is lost. It's not coming back, right? So you have the decrease in revenue is gone. What happens with the inflection back? Is it going to be a true inflection back to where it was? Is it going to happen in a short period of time, medium period of time, long period of time? I happen to think that it's going to take a while. So you've got a net loss of revenue. There's going to be a continued loss of revenue for a period of time, and that's on Medicare. On for commercially insured patients, you have a double whammy. One, the lost revenue is lost. Two, you've got a lot of people now who are unemployed, even if they're going to be reemployed, they have cash flow problems that are significant. The last thing they want to do is to shell out thousands of dollars for healthcare services. So we expect to see a utilization decrease across the board. And what the net effect of those is that we are seeing a lot of demand on the part of hospitals, health systems, independent physicians for volume. Back to, we're still in a volume game, right? Oh. And even if you have a global budget on a patient, you're if you're an ACO today, you're going back to your payers and say, send me more, I want more. And by the way, the deal that I made last year for those for the total cost to cure those patients, I'll give you 10% off if you send me more patients. Or the deal that, you know, I was willing to make on the episode of care, maybe it was upside only with whatever, I'm willing to take my price down by X thousands of dollars and I'll give you a full guarantee for 90 days. Because your fixed costs are your fixed costs. And if your revenue has decreased substantially, you're not going to be able to make up those fixed costs quickly. So we're seeing the supply side of the industry being in demanding more volume wherever they can get it, and being willing as a result to strike the deals that they weren't willing to strike before COVID. And that gives me encouragement at two levels. First of all, I think, again, it lays bare the deficiencies of the fee-for-service system, because in a full employment, fat healthcare system environment, you get price increases where you can, you get fee schedule increases where you can, you get volume where you can. When you actually have to compete for value, you have a different mindset. And on the other side, you've got employers. And employers are struggling financially. They've lost revenue. They're not going to make up that revenue anytime soon. So how do you compensate for that? You're going to find ways to cut costs. And that means you're going to want to strike deals and bargains wherever you can.
So this is sort of fascinating. The scramble for getting patients and knocking down your price is the... We might get some value out of that, you know, because people will have to deliver service at a lower price. So I mean, I hate to talk about an upside of a pretty horrid epidemic of infectious disease, but it could be one of these silver lining situations.
Huh? Well, it's competition. We are shifting towards a more competitive, even in markets that are highly consolidated, we're shifting to a more competitive environment because providers are now hungry for business and they cannot jack up their prices because there's no appetite and there's no ability, even if there was, there's just no ability on the demand side, employers and individuals, to pay more for individual services. So everyone is in a cash crunch recessionary environment in which if you want to stay afloat, you have to find a way to make a deal. So I actually think that the combination of all of those things is going to accelerate some forms of episode of care payments because you want to make a deal. And it also, on the specialty side, primary care side, speaks to having alternative payment models that give you more fixed, clear, targeted budgets for the management of patients' underlying conditions. My friend's father, if he knew that for every patient who has a combination of heart failure and other conditions, he had a $10,000 or $15,000 a year budget for that patient, he wouldn't have had to lay off his physician assistant. He would have found ways to try to continue to communicate, do telehealth, without worrying about whether or not that telehealth is going to be reimbursed or not reimbursed, because you have a budget. And what you're trying to do in managing that budget and managing that patient is getting them the best care that you can. And you're not worried about the cash flow because you are getting on a monthly basis an allowance for that monthly installment of whatever that the care for that patient. So I'm hopeful, and it is to your sense. It's we don't want to make say that it's a COVID was a good thing, because it wasn't. It was a terrible thing. But if you draw the right lessons from a bad event, good things can come from it.
Okay, so let's have you play devil's advocate, or, you know, alternate historian. So you think that this one consequence of COVID might be through competition and trying to capture patients that is going to end up sort of driving more value into the system. So just as a critical thinker, how could it play out in a way that that won't occur? are there other forces at play that would prevent this sort of negotiation and dropping of price that you're talking about?
Sure, because it takes two to tango. And you need to make, if you're going to have a deal, you need to be able to make a deal and you need to be able to execute on that deal. So you can have a delivery system eager to strike bargains on episodes of care. You can have employers eager to take those deals. But unless you have someone in the middle that can help the demand and the supply side meet, it may not happen. And carriers are coming out, at least from the numbers I'm seeing and the reports on Wall Street, carriers are coming out of COVID with surpluses that they likely are going to have to redistribute back to employers, because at least the fully insured employers, because their medical loss ratio may end up by being greater than or lower than 80%. And so the from the carrier's perspective, things are okay. They're not okay for employers. They're not okay for providers. So I think part of the role that we Signify need to play is that matchmaker, and continue to do that on an accelerated basis. We're not the only ones. There are other organizations. And that's where you always worry, right? Which is the market's ready to move, but are the intermediaries that are necessary to make demand and supply meet ready to pick up that opportunity and make it happen?
You know, I was thinking as you were talking that this seems to me like it might actually lead to further consolidation, because it's going to be the big sophisticated systems that have access to large amounts of capital who are going to be more in a better position to, you know, offer employers, insurers these deals. You know, I can that I can take care of your heart failure patients for X amount of dollars less than I thought I could, or some that, you know, that's just a cartoon version of what we're talking about, but it just seems like that this might lead to further consolidation, which maybe in the short term would lead to value, but as we know, consolidation ends up leading to higher prices, you know, depending on the market share and so on. But are you worried about that? And is that, do you think?
I think most of us have been worried about consolidation for a long time, and the dire straits of many provider groups can lead to further consolidation into larger hospitals and health systems. But again, I think even for the larger ones who are well capitalized and are getting a lot of bailout money, do you have enough that most physician acquisitions by hospitals and health systems end up by being money losing? I mean, it's very rare that they end up by being accretive. So you're buying business and consolidating in the hopes of something happening down the road, which is either, again, that's your way of buying volume, or by consolidating the market, you can create more pressure on price increases. But the pressure on price increase is going to be very tough to exert. Finding the discretionary cash to buy the practices, even if you're well capitalized, is going to be, I think, difficult. Accessing capital markets even though the banks have lots of money and the Fed is backing them up, the appetite for tax-exempt bonds from organizations who are suffering significant losses is huge. So I think, you know, there's lots of things going on in the general ecosystem that say, yeah, maybe in certain circumstances you're going to fight buyouts of practices by hospitals and health systems. So that's back to if the employers, the carriers, and intermediaries like Signify do their jobs, we can help create the matchup between the supply and the demand and try to at least mitigate for some of that potential further consolidation. But it's not as if consolidation is new. Do we want to see it accelerated? No.
Yeah, right, right. So just a couple more questions. You know, there's been a critique that these payment models are not having the bite that they need because they aren't two-sided risk. It's all been sort of bonuses and not penalties. And I think CMS has, in particular, on the ACO model, been pushing aggressively for two-sided risk to, I guess, eventually effectuate more value to create a stronger incentive. So, but if everybody's hurting and struggling with revenue, isn't two-sided risk gonna be a can that gets kicked down the road again, and maybe we won't see these models, and maybe the AC model in particular, have the effect on delivery and bringing value into the healthcare system that we want to see. Of course, this is stipulated on a belief that two-sided risk is the stick that's needed, but
It's a great question. So let me just answer it quickly in a couple of ways. One, I think the signal is pretty strong that for the Medicare ACO program, at least for this year, there's going to be relief because you can't deal with all of this stuff at the same time and incur losses on populations that you couldn't even manage and were told not to manage. But setting that aside, hope to have a healthcare blog post over the next, the health affairs blog post over the next couple of weeks with two co-authors, Meredith Rosenthal from the Harvard School and Jerome Struess from Amsterdam, about the difference between risk and uncertainty in a lot of these episodic care or other alternative payment models. And providers are very willing to take on risk. What's challenging to them is when the model proposed by the payer has so much uncertainty built into it that it becomes a game of chance as opposed to a game of skill. And what we're seeing in the programs that are designed so that it's not a game of chance, but it's a game of skill, there's great uptake. I mean, the Medicare bundle payment for care improvement is a great example. You've got tens of billions of dollars of episodes of care that are being managed by providers fully at risk across the United States. And in the programs that we're working on the private sector, we see demand and uptake on at-risk episodes of care, partially because the design quantifies the risk and gets rid of the uncertainty that, you know, really makes it very, very difficult for providers to say yes. So back to my earlier comment of, if you want to make a deal, the deal to an employer can't be upside only. The deal to an employer is going to have to be, I'm willing to take care of your patient, to take care of this particular condition, to take care of this particular procedure at this price. That's the only thing you're going to have to pay, and I'll put my guarantee on it. Right? That's a double-sided risk contract.
Yeah, right, right.
And so I felt really strongly as I've looked at the literature, and you know, Meredith and Jerome have done a tremendous work on this also in a recent publication in the Commonwealth Fund or Milbank, that ultimately it is about the design of the program, and it's about the design elements of the program. I get frustrated by, and we work a lot with providers who share with us the programs that are being brought to them by carriers. And I take a look at it, and my colleagues take a look at it and say, we'd never take risk. You know, Signify takes risk with providers every day. We'd never take risk on that particular program because the way it's designed introduces so much uncertainty, or it's so lopsided that you'd have to be nuts to accept it. And so then you have the carriers going back to employers and saying, well, we can't find any providers that are willing to take double-sided risk. You know, it's upside only. And I think the short answer is, you're not finding them because the way you're structuring your contracts, the way you're structuring the deal doesn't make sense. And Right. It's not that difficult, but it's a really important concept in economics that dates back to 100 years ago, the difference between risk and uncertainty. And you can have a risk contract and people willing to take risk, but when you introduce massive amounts of uncertainty, like what we're living through now with COVID, it changes the game. It's a different type of game. So they'll put their money where their skills are. Well, why would they risk their financial future on something that has a completely uncertain outcome?
So without going too far into the weeds, could you identify one element in these contracts that introduces this uncertainty that sort of makes it so there are no takers? I mean, is there
sure.
a sterling example, you know, just one signature element that you...
Yeah, many programs end up by, on the back end of the program, reshuffling the deck on what your performance is, because it's going to be based on that of everyone else in the network, or everyone else that is in the program. So you start out the program with a target, knowing full well that that target is going to shift at the end of the performance period based on what everyone else has done. It's what you can call a tournament style program. And tournament style programs are, by their very design, completely uncertain. Because I can work the entire year and improve my performance by 30%. If everyone else improves their performance by 40%, I'm on the losing end of that deal. Why would you sign up for something like that? That's a classic example of introducing a real uncertainty into a program, whereby I can no longer quantify the risk. And as a result, it's a complete game of chance. Maybe I'm better than my colleagues. Maybe my colleagues are better than me. Maybe the rest of the network is better than me. I don't know. But I'm not going to take the risk with my money and my savings on that deal. And that's a perfect example of introducing significant amount of uncertainty in a contract that will by its nature reduce uptake.
So it's the solution then, or what you've seen, more to put it more succinctly, is in terms of what you've seen work out there, is it a question of being sort of graded against yourself, or do you just set a target amount and price, and it doesn't move, and you arrive at it and you live by it?
Exactly. And you can have a little bit of an adjustment based on changes in case mix, because you don't want people playing games on.
Yeah.
But yes, you fix a target. And Medicare does a great job at that with the bundle payment program. Whether you like it or not, whether you like the price or you don't like the price is a different issue. But once the price is set, the price is set. That's the target. You know what it is, and you're working towards it. So that certainty means now it's a game of skill, right? Right. And we've seen how working with providers, you can generate savings, you can quantify them, and you can work towards that goal. So I think there are very good examples of good programs, well designed, and there are also lots of examples of programs that are very poorly designed.
When you referenced the Medicare bundle payment program, were you talking about bundle payment for Care Improvement Advanced in particular?
And that one fixed a lot of the issues that I think have been reported on the bundle payment for Care Improvement Classic. And, you know, similarly, there are now lots of reported issues in Medicare's oncology care model, which we hope will get addressed and fixed in Oncology Care First. Because cancer care, we see, and certainly in the private sector, it's a big deal. Lots of employers want to see bundles, episodes of care for cancer care. It's, you know, the OCM doesn't make sense from that perspective, and it certainly makes very little sense for most providers to take on full financial risk. But again, there are ways of modifying the design of that program so it becomes a skill-based program as opposed to one of chance.
Well, let's just quickly talk about the OCM and its successor, Oncology Care First. And you and I have had some communication about this before. Do you think that the adjustments made to OCM and as manifested in this Oncology Care First fixed the problems with oncology care model? And maybe you could just discuss in what ways they are or are not fixed.
Yeah, and I'll give you just one example that again is one of the design elements that you know, we think is essential. The OCM and the OCF, as at least introduced today, have a construct that includes all costs of care associated to that particular beneficiary during the performance period. Everything, not just the cancer care, everything.
Right.
And at some level, if you're going to do an ACO program, do an ACO program. It's total cost of care. If you're going to do an episodic care payment program focused on oncology, why are you including the totality of the care of a patient as opposed to just their cancer care? And there are a lot, I don't want to get into all the reasons why payers do that, but if I'm the oncologist, that's what I'm managing. I'm managing the patient's cancer. If that patient ends up by having, during the care of the cancer, breaks their hips, needs a hip replacement, yeah. it's nonsensical. Another big principle of designing programs is you can hold providers accountable for what's in their locus of control. Once it goes way beyond their locus of control, it just doesn't make sense to them, and it doesn't make sense, period. So that's a good example of just fix that. Include all of the cancer care. Include the things that are within the control of the oncologist, but exclude the things that are clearly not under the control and over which they have absolutely no influence whatsoever. The cancer drug costs are the same. Most of these drug costs are negotiated by third parties. The physicians may have a slight ability, but it's very slight in negotiating the differences in these drug prices. Manufacturers can decide to increase them at their whim. If those drug costs increase during the course of the performance period, and you're charging that increase to me without adjusting my baseline, that's cuckoo. Right? So very small examples of things that create so much uncertainty that the outcome can be have nothing to do with my skill and the way I'm managing patients. It's just the luck of the draw.
Participation in OCM has been pretty high, so, yeah, right?
Upside only.
Oh, okay. Right. So do you think the program, the OCF, the Oncology Care First, is sort of fatally flawed and just won't work?
I think if the uptake, if it stays the way it's designed currently, the uptake will be very low. And it's a lost opportunity. So that's my big beef is you then have pundits and others saying, well, these programs don't work because no one picks them up. They don't work because the design is bad and the design prevents the uptake. So that's my continued frustration. And as you said, I've been at this for a while. And there's nothing more frustrating than seeing sophisticated payers come out with programs that are poorly designed. And I can tell from the get-go, this is not going to work. And on the back end, folks will say, you see, it didn't work. It doesn't work. These programs don't work. And no, they work very well when they're well designed.
They say, well, it won't fly. And you say, well, that's because you don't have any wings on the plane.
Exactly. you don't have any wings and you have one propeller, but you don't have a rudder. So you're not going anywhere.
Yeah. So what are you working on yourself? You know, what is your particular project list look like today? And then over the next few weeks,
I'm really excited about the ability and the programs that we're bringing live that include all kinds of episodes. And I think it is the first time in my career where we're bringing programs to go live on chronic conditions, including substance use disorders, long-term procedural cases like maternity, basic procedures, you know, a whole panoply and library of episodes that cover a large swath of medical spend. And I've been hoping to get to the point in my career where I'd work for an organization that could do this stuff broadly, broad scope and at scale. And we're finally there. It took a long time, but we have two programs that are going live in the next 60 days. And it's really exciting. And so once that's done, you know, then the next phase. And I am looking at trying to figure out now how to do cancer episodes. And we're working with one of our customers, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, on a potential pilot around cancer episodes. It's very early. We're still trying to design it, figure it out how it could work. But that's the appetite, right? So the folks who are in this and understand the potential for these programs really want to see it expand and want to see the scope expand. And there are lots of challenges. There's lots of barriers. There's lots of unknowns. But the demand side and the supply side are finally meeting together on broad scope programs. So that's what I'm continuing to work on. And I see the demand for it increasing. And as we talked about earlier, I also see the current environment being very conducive to that increase.
Can you tell me today what those two programs are, or are you waiting to unveil them? And
No, because these are public knowledge, and we've executed agreements with these organizations. So we have Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield in the Pacific Northwest, and the State of Connecticut State Employee Plan that covers about 250,000 people in the state. So both of those are going fully live in the next 60 days. And
but what episodes are we talking about? What sort of care?
Well, in the state of Connecticut, it's everything.
Oh.
Yeah, chronic conditions, maternity, procedural episodes.
Everything. I see. It's the whole menu. We're no longer talking a la carte.
The whole menu, everything. And so specialists are taking some, hospitals and health systems are taking others. You know, no one's really taking all episodes because not everyone is good at everything. Surprise. But it's and the state is you know, we have incentives for state employees to go and seek out the higher performing providers. So it's a very exciting multi-dimensional program. With Regions Blue Cross, we're starting with a number of procedural episodes and moving very quickly in deploying condition episodes behind those. So those two, I think, will finally help reshape the dialogue around what can be the scope of these programs. And hopefully in the next few years, as results come out, we'll be able to say, and you know what, when it's designed the right way, it works.
So bundled payment or episodic care?
Well, I use the word episodes of care. The words episodes of care because it has a finite time associated with it, and it's really because the contract itself or the price is bounded in time. So for chronic conditions, it's a year. For procedural episodes, it can be less than that. Ultimately, it is a bundled payment of a number of services that are grouped around a condition, a health event, a procedure. But the broad nomenclature that I always use is episodic care payment programs.
So we can talk about both bundle payment and episodes of care.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Good. I was thinking maybe you'd settled on episodes because of Netflix, and we're all used to watching episodes now. Well, it's been really good talking with you, seeing you long distance, and good luck with bringing episodes of care and bundled payment to American healthcare. It's been a journey, and let's hope you get to the summit.
It has been a journey. It's been facilitated really by Medicare and others, and we hope it'll continue for a while.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.